Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from Now at Ohio State, a new podcast featuring researchers, innovators, and bold thinkers who look at our world, see what the real challenges are, and create the solutions that people need now. Available on your favorite podcast platform or visit go.osu.edu/now.
Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. Playing dress-up has entered the digital age. Young video game players are increasingly dressing up avatars to represent themselves in the virtual world. In fact, half of Gen Zers change their avatars' clothing at least weekly, and they sometimes drop a pretty penny to do so. The esteemed Parsons School of Design has taken note of these shifting fashion trends, and they're offering a first-ever avatar design course called Collab Roblox. Wall Street Journal technology reporter Sarah E. Needleman recently wrote about this fashion trend. Welcome back to All Sides, Sarah.
Great to be here.
So tell me about this idea of Roblox. Okay. So I have a young daughter and she is immersed in the Roblox world. And so by extension, I am. So for the uninitiated, let's start with, can you tell me what is Roblox?
Sure. I'm in the same place as you with a daughter who's also an avid Roblox user. Roblox is a platform online. It's free and it's filled with millions of games and game-like experiences. Anyone can create these games. The company doesn't actually make them. Third parties do, which could be hobbyists or professional developers. And the way you as a player see yourself is in the form of an avatar. And you can customize the look of that avatar. So you're running around different game worlds, meeting up with friends, and you're represented by this little animated figure. And you can customize the look of that figure, both in terms of like the hairstyle and skin color, but also, of course, the outfit it's wearing.
Yes. Why has dressing them up become such a thing? In fact, that the Parsons Design School is offering a course on it.
Well, if you think about it this way, if you were handed some sort of blank slate of a character to do anything in life, whether it be playing a game or anything online, you might want to make that character look like you, or maybe you want to make it look totally different. But just like in the real world where we care about how we look in front of other people around us, we dress up for work, we dress up to go on dates, the same thing happens in the virtual world. These players want to make sure their characters look just like they would like them to look, and attractive and pretty or funky, whatever it is. Mm-hmm. It's just an extension of the real world concept of picking out our outfit every morning.
So tell me about the Parsons Design School. I mean, the pinnacle of fashion design. Tell me about them getting involved in this digital world, making digital clothing instead of physical clothing.
It's very different than what they're used to. If they've taken regular fashion courses, there's no scissors or tape required, no sewing machine. You're doing this online. You are first designing, you're drawing, sketching by hand, what you envision a certain outfit to look like. But when it comes to actually making it, you're on the computer working with Roblox. In this case, Roblox has a developer kit that you can use. It doesn't require deep-seated coding knowledge. That's why I was saying earlier, anyone can make a game on Roblox, and that applies to the fashion too. You don't need to be a digital whiz. You have to have some tech savvy, but there are almost like a turnkey process for doing the actual creation, but the ingenuity comes from the designer, him or herself, to think of a particular look. And so this class has these students designing for this particular audience, this type of figurine. It's not like, you know, a normal body size. And they're learning the technical aspect of it, how to actually take their idea and put it onto the computer and have it uploaded so that people could buy the clothing and put it on their characters.
So, you know, 1 minute, I asked my daughter about it last night, and, you know, 1 minute her avatar can be wearing a chicken outfit, and then the next minute she can be dressed up as a beauty queen, and then she's wandering around in a house that she built and designed in a different game, you know, that kind of thing. So it's a way to play dress up in ways that they don't get to in real life. I asked my daughter why she likes to do it, and she just said it's fun.
Yep, that's exactly it. It's fun to dress up. You can make yourself an outfit that you would never wear in real life because you don't have the body for it, or you're too embarrassed, or it's just really wild. And the other cool thing is that you can wear things that just can't even possibly exist in the real world. For example, you could have a dress that's perpetually on fire in Roblox. Obviously, in the real world, that wouldn't work. You could also have outfits made of virtual materials that in the real world, those materials would sag down and just wouldn't work. But in the virtual world, you can be flexible. You can pretty much do anything. So you have a lot more opportunities to be creative with your outfits. And that can be a lot of fun. Some people want to look just like they do in real life, but others want to go wild and wear that fire dress or a dress made of water or lava or any material you can possibly conceive of.
So this must be fun for the Parsons Design School students because they can make something and they don't actually have to cut the fabric and sew it together. They can, their imagination can just go wild.
Exactly. And it's also, I mean, arguably more affordable because, you know, fabrics are very expensive in the real world. So, you know, here they can do whatever they want, have any material, any amount, because there's no limit to how much you do. And what's also interesting with Roblox is they've started dabbling with artificial intelligence, and you could use that to come up with materials that aren't currently available in their developer kit and create them on your own. So there really are no boundaries here. You have a lot of flexibility. And for these students, it was a lot of fun. It was challenging. Don't get me wrong. It wasn't an easy A. They said they had a lot of learning to do in terms of what styles would work in Roblox, or what consumers or kids like your daughter and mine would like, and also just the understanding the technical aspect of it and getting it together. It's not easy, but it is fun.
Now, for the visual, someone can do a Google image search right now to just type in Roblox and you can see the visual. But this is not sophisticated animation. We're not talking like Pixar quality in some of these Roblox games. So,
I will say that Roblox has made other newer avatars that do look a lot more realistic. But the most popular ones tend to be the classic blocky type with no fingers and their knees don't really bend. I mean, it's very primitive looking, and that's what's most popular.
And that's what they're designing clothes for, these blocky characters, right?
They can design clothes for both. So the blocky characters or the newer ones that are more realistic. The students are going in both directions, but since a lot of the players prefer the classic look, certainly students are trying to experiment with both.
So when I asked my daughter to show me her avatar and change its clothes and hair a few times last night, in return, in exchange for her time, I bought her some Robux. So that's what the money in Roblox is called, Robux. So who got a cut of my money? Did a fashion designer? Or did a game designer? Who got my money?
Okay, so if you bought it from the avatar shop, the designer of that outfit received a 30% cut. I'm sorry, received 70% cut, and
70%.
Roblox takes a 30% cut of that. And they're paid in Robux, and they convert it back into dollars if they so choose. But that is the way it works. It is very cutthroat. There are countless numbers of items to buy on Roblox. It's not just clothing. It's also shoes and hats and hairstyles and weapons and capes. So to make a living as a designer of fashion on Roblox, it is quite challenging, but if you're lucky and or you're really good and your item goes viral, you can make a pretty penny too. So
can I buy the Parsons Design collection? Can I find Parsons pieces yet?
You can. The class recently ended, and you should be able to go up on the site and find a special section in the avatar shop specifically for the students' designs.
And from the people you spoke with, what other avenues does this open up to them in terms of the fashion industry? You know, gaming and tech are influence everything in our world now.
Right. So you have to imagine just about any software program that involves avatars where there's like some sort of little character that's meant to represent you. This could be in the workplace, and you might want to dress your avatar with work appropriate attire, or perhaps you're at a company that's really loose and you could show up as a gorilla. But you can imagine any sort of virtual reality type software where you're a character, obviously many other games. And now with Apple's new headset, there may be more opportunities. We see also Meta's headset. These are a lot of the programs available through those do offer avatars. So it's not just games, although games are for sure the majority of it. But as we move closer and closer to this metaverse concept, which is a very slow grind, but the reality is that the irony is that the reality is many users will be represented by these little characters, and they'll want to customize them because you certainly don't want just a blank character running around. You might want with hair or glasses or a beard or whatever. And whether it's a game or a work setting, you want to have fun and decorate your character.
And there's different levels of ways to make it. I mean, I guess the design students have to learn, you know, primitive coding, because there's different ways you can just slap a dress onto a character, but you need to make it look like the character's actually wearing it. And it has to look nice for it to be appealing.
True. I mean, luckily in the case of Roblox, they provide a lot of that back end coding. You don't have to have like a master's degree in computer science to put together an outfit on the platform. I mean, there is a learning curve, don't get me wrong, and it's not something just everybody could just jump into. But a lot of the heavy lifting is done by Roblox. On other platforms, it may be different, and not all platforms invite third parties to create fashion. But we have seen some companies hire people out of these schools to do just that, to make avatar clothing. And you'll see lots of games that have all sorts of funky outfits, Fortnite, for example. So there's definitely some budding demand and a growing demand for fashion designers in the tech space specifically.
So I could see a job posting where they want to give Mario and Luigi new clothes and they're hiring a designer, right? Something like that.
That's a possibility, although Nintendo's pretty tight with its IP, so I don't know about that. But beyond that, certainly, and you know, your daughter, when she grows up and is ready to graduate from college and pursue a career, if this is something that interests her, by then there could be a very large universe of avatars in need of, cool outfits. And so
this could extend into hair design too, I guess, right?
Oh, so
you
absolutely
can make the avatar's hair do something that your real hair can't, right?
Exactly. You could have it up in a, you know, beehive bun. You can have short hair one day, long hair the next, any color, mohawk, glasses, facial hair, hats. I mean, it's endless, and that's part of the appeal.
I read a fun statistic that over half of kids in the U.S. under the age of 16 have played Roblox in 2020.
That's a lot. They have about 66 million daily average users as of their last earnings. And it is a very, very popular platform. It's free and easy to use, and you can see where your friends are. So if you hop on and you've already made a relationship with other players, it'll have a little glowing message telling you they're in this game, and you can press a button, just automatically appear next to them. And so it's wildly popular for that reason, and all the different experiences, so many different games, really something for everyone.
And it's been around for a while. I mean, I had not heard of it until 2020-ish, I guess, I think. But it's been around for a long time.
Right. I think the company was founded, I believe, in 2006, and it went live around that time, shortly thereafter. And it's been gradually growing in terms of the content. It has millions of games today. It wasn't that way always. And it's just grown in popularity. And certainly the pandemic gave it a massive boost. So many children were stuck at home. And this is a way for children not only to be entertained, but to socialize. Because a lot of times you're communicating with other players. Either you're using a voice chat, which is a new feature actually now on Roblox for ages 13 up. But a lot of kids would just use their phones to have a conversation, or they would chat by text. So it's very social. It's not just your average video game platform. It's a place for hanging out with your friends, and even hosts concerts. So you can go see your favorite bands, in some cases, perform. I mean, they look like Roblox avatars, but it's really them singing on the venue, sometimes live, sometimes recorded. But it's pretty exciting. So it's multifaceted.
Yeah, so the games are made by players, developers are making money, gamers are making money, and you think it's just going to keep growing. One of the most popular games, I think, is called Adopt Me, had 27 billion visits last year.
Yep, I mean, wildly popular. My daughter plays that one as well. There's a number of them. Fashion Famous was another one.
Fashion Famous is like a you put clothing on and you do like a runway show. That would be that's where you need your Parsons outfit, right?
Exactly. That's where the really wild fashions come in. So there's so many experiences. There's hide and seek games. There's a game where it's called Natural Disaster and you're hiding from a, you know, all earthquake or flooding or whatever. There's all sorts of things. Very creative stuff.
All right. Well, we have been talking about the video game Roblox and how fashion designers are getting involved in making fashion for avatars and just the future of that. And we have much more to come on Tech Tuesday. I want to say thank you to Sarah Needleman, the tech reporter for the Wall Street Journal. Thanks for being here.
You're welcome.
And this is Tech Tuesday. This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.
Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from Now at Ohio State, a new podcast featuring researchers, innovators, and bold thinkers who look at our world, see what the real challenges are, and create the solutions that people need now. Available on your favorite podcast platform or visit go.osu.edu/now.
From an Iraq war cover-up to towns ravaged by opioids to the roots of our modern immigration crisis, Embedded explores what's been sealed off and undisclosed. NPR's original investigative podcast reveals why these stories and the people behind them matter. Listen to the Embedded podcast, only from NPR.
Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. The ultimate goal of the space race in the 1960s was landing on the moon. Today, all eyes are on Mars. This once unthinkable ambition is now talked about as a plausible mission. Travel to the red planet would be hard, taking 9 months cooped up in a tiny spacecraft, to say nothing of surviving a landing or the inhospitable environment. The thin air there is almost entirely made up of carbon dioxide, and the temperatures are as cold as Antarctica. To prepare, 4 crew members will live for a year in a small 3D-printed habitat that simulates the Martian environment. Ramin Skibba is a writer, a space writer for Wired magazine, and he wrote about the Mars simulation last week. He formerly was an astrophysicist and specializes in galaxies and dark matter. And welcome to the show, Ramin. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
So can you tell us about this simulator? So it's on here on Earth, and it's duplicate life on the red planet. So what? How do you do that? What's that like?
Yeah, so it comes in a line of a series of other simulations. They're called analog simulations, and this one is called the Chappia program. It's actually in a giant hangar at Johnson Space Center in Houston, but the habitat is surrounded by these other structures and murals and everything. So when you step outside the habitat, it looks like you're on Mars. They're taking like images from Mars, and anytime they're called crew. The 4 crew members are trying to communicate. There is a delay as if they were on Mars. So you can't just have a live, you know, phone call with mission control or with your family or anything like that. It takes at least 20 minutes for your signal to reach them, and then at least 20 minutes for it to come back. So it can be an hour before you get a response. And so that sort of adds to the isolation. And it's going to be a whole year. As you know, like what might be a typical Mars mission in 20 years.
So 4 crew members are going to live for a year in this 3D printed habitat. Can you give us an idea of the dimensions? How big is it?
I believe it is 1,700 square feet, and it has each crew member has their own small room. It's very small. It's kind of like you know, like a kind of like IKEA furniture in a just a space for like a bed and a table, basically. And then there is a common, you know, eating area. There is a kitchen, although they're very limited in the kind of food they can have. And there's a work area where they do, you know, they maintain some equipment and they do some other things.
So the idea is, even though they're in Houston, Texas, they are supposed to seem like they are on Mars. So if they do go outside, do they have to wear a spacesuit, I'm guessing, right?
Yes. And so they do get a number of, you know, Mars walks, as they're calling them, a week. And basically it's there's tons of red sand all around. So it's not like it looks like, you know, Texas. It's you know, looks like Mars. I mean, I'd be curious to see if maybe a weed might poke through by the end of the mission, but it will look like Mars when they step outside that habitat.
And it'll have the thin air of Mars, right?
Well, that will be Earth air, but
okay.
But they will be wearing the suit as if it were, you know, as if it were Mars.
Are they going to make it cold? I read that Mars is as cold as Antarctica.
Yes, so that they can't do. Like this is more a simulation to see, you know, how people can handle the conditions.
Okay, so it's more of a psychological experiment rather than the physical part too.
Yeah, and that's what I find particularly fascinating, because people have focused on the technological engineering challenges for obvious reasons. You can't go without it. However, if something were to go wrong, if somebody, you know, say a crucial member of the crew has a debilitating case of depression, or if there are, you know, is a fight between crew members or something like that, and this is something that you're not prepared for, then that can, you know, end a mission just as easily as a rocket explosion or you know, a loss of, you know, air pressure in the habitat.
So these crew members are going to be together, the four of them, for a year doing this experiment. Did they take the time to figure out if they're compatible?
They have gotten done some training, and they're doing some training right now. Actually, they're about to step in a couple weeks, and so they already know each other fairly well, and so they do seem to be at least so far anyway compatible. We'll continue to you know enjoy being amongst after a whole year, but yeah, that is an important factor.
Can they communicate with family or just mission control?
They can communicate with family too, but that is also subject to the same delay, just because Mars is far enough from Earth that it takes time for that message to be received and then to be sent back. And you can send a video message too, but it's not like you can do a Zoom call or a phone call because of how far away they are.
Okay, so this is not total isolation, because there are four of them, but it will play a psychological toll. So, you've written extensively about the psychological toll of isolation. What does the research show about that? What does that do to a human?
Yeah, so like the most extreme case of isolation is solitary confinement. And then you can have, and some people, they have symptoms, they have conditions that are temporary. And then for other people, it, you know, messes with their brain and their behavior for the rest of their life. And so you can have things like, I mean, depression is a big issue. People will become increasingly irritable and moody. They might be having, you know, have trouble sleeping or trouble eating, and they may like self-isolate just because they've gotten used to isolating. And so it's or even though they can communicate with mission control and their family, there may sort of be like a us versus them thing, like they may feel like, oh, people on the outside don't understand, you know, there's that kind of potential issue. But yeah, it's not as isolating as solitary confinement, which has been shown to be potentially damaging to people's minds after, you know, even just a couple weeks. But you know, I mean, we've experienced the pandemic. We know a small taste of isolation. And so it's something that you can get through, but it's something that, you know, you can't take lightly. It's definitely serious. And I believe NASA is monitoring these conditions. And so if there are signs of someone going through experiencing these symptoms and having trouble, then you know, they can talk to them and potentially, you know, address it in some way.
So the point of this is to see if human beings can actually psychologically do a mission to Mars and to give NASA ways to help them through it, right?
That's right, yes.
And so this is kind of like step one of a million billion steps on getting to Mars, right?
That's right. Yeah. I mean, the Mars habitat may very well be similar to the one that they are staying in here. And so so NASA is working on that. And both, you know, the NASA's Space Launch System rocket or SpaceX's Starship could potentially bring people there. And so that, you know, NASA and its commercial and international partners are working on every possible step they can. But it's in all likelihood, it's not going to happen until the 2040s that someone actually goes to Mars. But those first people will be, you know, in for a challenging trip.
We are talking about the idea of living on Mars and a test of your mental fitness. NASA's year-long Mars simulation is going to test some crew members on what it would be like to go on a mission to Mars. This is Tech Tuesday on 89.7 NPR News. And with me is Ramin Skiba, a space writer for Wired magazine. Now, the closest I have been thinking about living on Mars is watching the Matt Damon movie when he had his struggles in the movie The Martian. So I know that movie is very fictional, but I read a lot of stuff about that his character came up with to survive in that movie was based on real science. So, you know, will the four crew members in this model have to, like, MacGyver anything like they did in that movie?
We should hope not. You will want to be, you know, innovative with your, you want to be able to deal with problems that as they come up, including ones that you had not anticipated. And so you want crew members who have complementary abilities. And, you know, there may be situations on Mars where, say, you have a problem with the power system or the, you know, the oxygen generating system, or with, you know, your water supply or the food supply. Almost everything went catastrophically wrong in The Martian. But it won't be quite like that. But, you know, you want to be ready for as many possible problems that could arise.
So they don't have to learn how to grow their own potatoes in Martian soil then?
No. There probably will be some food grown, you know, at least some plants grown in treated Martian soil, but whether they can feed themselves entirely on that is that's a really challenging thing to do.
So they're going to have to eat meals, kind of like if they were going on a mission to Mars. NASA would pack up all of these pre-made meals to last them for the whole trip, right? Will they be eating those?
Yeah, exactly. It's like on the space station, but, you know, harder to send, you know, a cargo resupply mission.
Right. So on the space station, they do get resupplied every few months, and it won't be the same for this, because resupplying would take someone a year to get the supplies there, right?
Yeah, I mean, you could potentially, I mean, it wouldn't surprise me if NASA planned something where you send the crew, and while the crew are still en route, you send a cargo resupply mission following them. And mm-hmm. so you know, halfway through the mission, they get extra supplies, including, who knows, maybe some relatively fresh vegetables or something. Mm-hmm. But as far as fresh food goes, it's going to be very limited.
So these four crew members who are doing this for a year in this 3D printed simulator, are they the leading candidates to get to actually make a trip to Mars, or will they be, you know, out of luck by 2040?
That's a good question. I'm not sure. I think maybe a couple of these people may very well be candidates to go to Mars. But, you know, the astronaut corps, you know, changes over time. So in all likelihood, it will probably be someone else.
And so they're doing the preliminary tests, because you have to test and plan everything whenever it comes to trying to figure out space travel, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. So this is very important. And you know, a successful Mars mission depends on tests like this.
And the U.S. has a goal for returning to the moon as well. These different missions and these different trips are, you know, being worked on simultaneously. What do we hope for a return trip to the moon as well?
Well, so the for the moon, NASA has the Artemis program, and late next year, there will be four astronauts going around on a NASA Orion spacecraft around the moon. And then after that, there will be the Artemis 3 mission, hopefully in 2025. And if SpaceX Starship is ready, they will use a modified Starship as a lander, and humans will be back on the moon just over a half century since they last were there. And then after that, there are plans to, you know, build structures on the moon, just like, you know, this kind of 3D printed structure, to build a lunar space station called Gateway. And there are international partners and commercial partners that are working on that as well. And so there's also a lot of commercial activity that is gradually coming together. So we could see a lot of activity on the moon over the next, you know, 10, 15 years before the first astronauts are on their way to Mars.
Do you see building, you know, a physical space station on the moon before Mars happening?
I mean, there will be an orbiting space station around mm-hmm. the moon before people go to Mars. I don't know exactly how many structures that will be built on the moon by then, but there may be some. China and Russia are planning their own research station on the moon. So I think I would guess that by 2040 there will be at least one NASA structure, one Chinese structure, and who knows, maybe a commercial habitat as well.
And how have international relations evolved when it comes to space travel, you know, sharing knowledge, supporting each other's missions? Are we, you know, U.S., China and Russia working separately on all of this moon stuff?
Yeah, space has had a lot of diplomacy, but as well, a lot of, international rivalry. There's always been tension with that. The International Space Station has sort of been a bastion of space diplomacy. Where you have, you know, U.S. and Russia, as well as European space agencies and Canada and Japan working together. It's looking like after the International Space Station, that sort of collaboration is going to be very rare, unfortunately, in my view. And so we'll have basically China doing their own thing, and then U.S. and its European, Canadian, and Japanese partners separately. Russia's space program is not quite the heavyweight that it has been in the past.
We have been talking about a future mission to Mars and what it would be like to live on Mars with this mission now seemingly plausible, but maybe not until 2040. And I want to say thank you to Ramin Skiba, a space writer for Wired magazine and an astrophysicist. Thank you so much for being with us today for Tech Tuesday.
Thank you.
And this is Tech Tuesday, and this is All Sides. I'm Amy Jurevich on 89.7 NPR News.
Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from Now at Ohio State, a new podcast featuring researchers, innovators, and bold thinkers who look at our world, see what the real challenges are, and create the solutions that people need now. Available on your favorite podcast platform or visit go.osu.edu/now.
From an Iraq war cover-up to towns ravaged by opioids to the roots of our modern immigration crisis, Embedded explores what's been sealed off and undisclosed. NPR's original investigative podcast reveals why these stories and the people behind them matter. Listen to the Embedded podcast, only from NPR.
Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. At its annual Worldwide Developers Conference, Apple unveiled an array of updates and new products. But none was as highly anticipated as its mixed-use headset, the Apple Vision Pro. Apple CEO Tim Cook called it a new kind of computer. Here to tell us more about it is Russell Hawley, Managing Editor for Commerce for CNET. Welcome back, Russell.
Thank you.
So, Russell, I'm looking at a picture of this headset. It looks like a ski mask with a thick, chunky strap on it, but it's been hailed as a new phase for Apple's hardware and software ecosystem. So why is everyone so excited about this ski mask?
So, you know, in order to kind of understand the excitement there, you almost have to go back a couple of years and take a look at the landscape for virtual reality and augmented reality headsets. Over the last 3 years in particular, the only real company out there doing stuff has been Facebook with the Meta Quest line of headsets. There really hasn't been a ton of competition. And when you have that kind of lack of competition, things tend to stagnate. Google stopped making these headsets. A lot of other companies that were trying to make these headsets found that there just wasn't enough money to be made there with the current set of technologies. So they kind of left that industry for a little while to see how things would shake out. But that whole time, there's been this rumor in the background that Apple was working on something. That, you know, for the last 10 years, the company's been kind of accumulating all these technologies in order to build something that was a way to kind of enhance the state of the art instead of the state of the market, which is something that Apple tends to pride itself on doing. And this headset came out. And from a mechanical perspective, it is a genuinely impressive piece of technology. It has 15 different cameras in it. Along with two processors to kind of gather all of that data and kind of constantly, be aware of its surroundings. If you're watching a movie and someone walks into the room, you actually see that person walk into the room. So you're not just kind of off in your own world unless you want to be. You can do things like play games on airplanes and take the screen for your laptop and expand it so that it's got a whole bunch of other screens around it. And if some of those things that I'm describing sound familiar, it's because they exist already in things like Microsoft HoloLens and a couple of different full dive VR headsets. Apple showed a really impressive piece of technology that is capable of essentially doing a bunch of stuff that you can already do inside of other headsets, which is odd, given that the kind of big push of technology, there was an expectation that with it would come new experiences and kind of things that you couldn't do before. But ultimately what we saw was a plea for developers to make things for Apple in order for this thing to eventually be a lot cooler than it is.
Okay, so but at a whopping $3,499, that's a lot of money. Who is the customer for this product?
That's a really great question that doesn't currently have an answer. For reference, for those who aren't giant VR nerds like me, Facebook's high-end virtual reality headset is $1,500, and that was designed specifically for enterprise users. And that price has actually dropped since then to $1,000 because developers said that was too much for this, kind of state-of-the-art headset that was being released in the Meta Quest Pro. And that headset has been around for a couple months now and is widely seen as this really impressive step forward. But the consumer version of that headset, which is called the Meta Quest 3, is only $500. So whether or not this headset is seven times better than what it was that Apple just if Apple's headset is seven times better than what Facebook just revealed, is unlikely. Especially given, a big focus for Meta's headset, whether you like Facebook or not, is all of these like fully immersive things. So you put the headset on and when you play a game, you're actually like swinging a sword or you're holding up a tennis racket or something like that. It's controller based and meant to be kind of engaged and dynamic. And you're standing there. The demonstration that Apple gave for its best case scenario for this headset out of the box was a dad who was checking his email via the headset while he was making his kid lunch. And then the kid came in with a soccer ball and kicked the soccer ball. And he kind of left the work that he was doing for a little while to kick the soccer ball back at his kid. I don't want that world. And I don't know a ton of other people who do. I would much prefer, there be a separation between the time that I'm spending with my family and the time that I'm at work. So encouraging a brand new headset to kind of merge those things doesn't personally excite me, but there may be others who feel differently.
For $3,500 to make my already to make my already chaotic life more chaotic, is that that's what that demo
right.
sounds like? Okay, so the dad who demoed it, I saw it more for like, you know, watching concerts or like having an experience in video games and that kind of thing. But Apple's trying to make it a part of real life, everyday life.
Apple very much wants this to be something that, you know, if you are at work, you're just sort of wearing as you sit down at your laptop. It plugs into your laptop and allows you to kind of expand that world to be slightly larger. It has a battery pack in it when you're not connected to your computer that'll last 2 hours. So the assumption is that you would put that headset on and either walk around your apartment or around your office or something like that and have that that tethered experience. That battery lives in your pocket and there's a big cable that comes up to the top of your head. I really have to pause for a moment and kind of make fun of Apple for referring to the cable as supple, because that's just a very silly thing to say when it comes to a cable that connects to a face computer. But that's kind of the overall experience. You know, this is Apple puts on a show. They get up and they say, this is the best version of something that could possibly exist. And we hope that you, the developers, will make something really cool for it before it comes out next year.
So another CNET reporter got to demo it. You did not get to try it out. You just saw it.
No, just one of us at a time. And Scott is our primary VR guy. Mm-hmm. So he was the one who went face first into this headset. I've talked to him quite a bit. He and I are kind of the two big VR nerds at CNET. So
what did he say?
We had a lot of expectations going into it. Visually, it is easily, from like a hardware perspective and the way that you get it set up and the way that you put it on, one of the most impressive experiences that you can possibly have, if a little on the creepy side. Part of the setup experience is holding the headset out in front of your head and it scans a picture of your face. And then when you put the headset on, it takes that picture and puts it in the display on the front so that people can see what they think are your actual eyes, but they are not, in fact, your actual eyes. They are a rendering of your eyes so that if you blink in the headset, then the display in front of you blinks. That facial scan also pulls into the FaceTime experience. So FaceTime is something that's available on this headset. And if you put the headset on and you take a call from your friends, you are obviously, you know, your face is busy because it's inside of this headset. But you can see all of your friends in kind of this nice boxy FaceTime experience. But what your friends see is a virtualized version of you that takes your facial movements and things like that and incorporates it into an animated version of you that they then see in FaceTime. And I promise you, the first time I do that, every single one of my friends will make fun of me. So that, I'm really, really excited for that to happen.
Well, you'll be the only one with one of these headsets unless all of your friends have $3,500 to spare, right?
And I promise absolutely none of them do. And even if they did, they're not interested in it at the moment.
Well,
so I will once again be alone with a weird face computer.
All right. Well, we can move on to Apple had lots of other things that they were unveiling as well. I mean, this was the showstopper, but Apple MacBook Air 15-inch. It's been a few years since Apple's had a 15-inch laptop. The larger screen is a nice change from the 13-inch model. But so why did Apple get out of the 15-inch size and why are they going back to it?
Yeah, so a lot of it comes down to, you know, where Apple could put the most money. You know, they knew that 13-inch laptops were selling more than some of the other sizes. I remind everyone that there was a time where Apple's favorite product was, in fact, a 17-inch laptop. And since then, computers have just gotten progressively smaller. And so Apple was following that trend. But a ton of developers and designers and things like that gave feedback to Apple that said, please bring back a 15-inch machine that is ultralight and also give us back magnetic charging through MagSafe. The last two generations of MacBooks have all charged via a USB Type-C, which is just a simple plug-in cable that charges as fast as it possibly can. And while that is great for people who want their laptop to charge in, you know, say under an hour, and then they can continue to go about their day, that magnetic cable makes a huge difference for anyone who's ever worked at home and had a kid or a dog run across a room and you know, kind of take a laptop with them as they do so. MagSafe has historically made that very easy because the magnet just disconnects and you don't have to worry about it as much. As my 55-pound Dalmatian regularly reminds me, that cable's not always my favorite thing in the world. So the magnetic cable is back. The larger display makes it so that more work can get done. Apple has done an enormous amount of work with its own processors, what it calls M2 silicon, to make it so that it performs just as well as any of the high-end Windows laptops. And doing so at a little over 3 pounds for this laptop, which is very cool.
Okay. And did they bump up the price or anything, or is it?
So what they actually did to make room for this laptop, they actually lowered the price of the 13-inch version to $1,000. And then they actually increased, they released this 15-inch version that's going to start at $1,400. And there'll be, you know, kind of different options if you want more storage and, you know, more, you know, RAM and things like that. But that base price, especially with a student discount, is actually pretty compelling.
And it has an 18 hours of battery life, but no fan.
That's right. The fan is something that is needed for more active cooling if your system demands it. Like I use a MacBook Pro, which has a whole bunch, you know, more things going on under the hood. And so there is a passive fan that occasionally kicks on when I'm doing something crazy. This uses the actual surface of the laptop to cool it. And if the 13-inch version of this is any indicator, it works very well.
Okay. Apple also unveiled something called Apple Vision Health. So lots of screen time can be hard on your eyes, and Apple wants to make its phone, it wants to make things on its phone easier on the eyes. So what can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so this actually comes in two different parts. One is really, you know, kind of fascinating for how Apple anticipates its people use things, and one is kind of for everyone. The one that's more general is distance measurement. All of these different things have cameras on them now, and almost everyone uses their camera to unlock either their phone or their tablet or their MacBook. And so Apple is using that technology to identify how close you are to your screen when you are using it, be it your iPhone or your MacBook or whatever. And the further you are from your screen, the less strain it is on your eyes, usually, especially if you're in rooms with kind of variable brightness, or you know, if you're in a darker room, that distance makes a functional difference on eye strain. So Apple is actually measuring every time you use that unlock, how close you are to your phone, and it's gathering that information to show you, hey, on average, you're only like 10 inches from your screen. You may want to consider trying to back that up a little bit and maybe increase it to 12 inches or 14 inches, because it'll have this effect on your eye health. So, and it's going to present that in the same way that it does like step tracking and stuff like that over time.
So will there be a pop-up on your screen telling you move your phone further away from your eyes, or is it you
that's the expectation, yeah. Mm-hmm. It'll give you basically Apple Health will include it as a part of their trend calculation. You know, so I get a message every once in a while that says, hey, on average, the number of steps you've taken in a given day has increased, or the amount of screen time that you've had has increased, because my phone likes to tell me that I have bad habits. And this one will basically be like, hey, you know, your average is about 10 inches. Consider, you know, kind of stepping that back a little bit or moving further.
I turned off that screen time thing because it was just depressing me. I didn't need to know how much time I was spending.
Well, you may potentially have another thing to turn off if you don't want your phone telling you how close you are to it to do things. Now, the other thing is actually designed for people who wear the Apple Watch, and it is a daylight measuring system. So your Apple Watch is constantly aware of what the brightness in your room is or wherever you are. Because it sets the brightness of the screen to match that. If you're outside where the sun is out, your screen will get brighter automatically for you to look and be able to actually see it. This measurement is something that Apple is going to present to you as information as well. And the argument that they made for it on stage was actually for children. They said that 30% of the world right now will struggle with myopia at some point in their lives. And a lot of that happens when you are younger. Is kind of the development of that condition in your eyes. And so one of the easiest ways to deal with myopia is to have up to 120 minutes a day of outdoor time. So like out in actual natural lighting where your eyes are kind of, you know, kind of constantly focusing on things at different lengths and adjusting to different lighting. So Apple is hoping that if you are the kind of person who puts an Apple Watch on your child, that you will be interested in how much time that kid is actually spending outside every day. And we'll give you that information as a part of the family plan that it has for Apple Health to say, hey, you know, your kid on average is only outside for 25 minutes a day. You know, if you extend that, then, you know, you could be improving their eye health potentially.
Okay. We only have 2 minutes left, and I just wanted to run through a couple of the other announcements that they made. They're going to add FaceTime on your TV.
This I actually think is pretty cool. I do a lot of FaceTime stuff with friends, especially if we're like watching TV or something, and being able to have the camera still be on my phone, but have all of the people be on the television, I'm personally excited about.
Yeah. And then another thing is, if you call someone on FaceTime and they don't answer, you're now going to be able to leave a video voicemail.
I really hope that Apple gives me control over who can leave me visual voicemails, because I've got like five friends that I would be okay with that happening. And I've got a whole lot of other friends who are going to leave really inappropriate things on my phone. So I really hope that I get some control over who can leave me a visual voicemail.
Well, from my kids like to FaceTime with grandparents, and sometimes the grandparents don't answer. And so being able to leave a voicemail saying, hey, we called, you know, that.
Yeah, I think the underlying technology is very cool. I just hope that there are some abuse mechanics involved.
Okay. And then the last one is a way to find your Apple remote if you lose it.
Yeah. So this is a way to, you know, Apple remotes are notorious for being small and for sliding into couch cushions. And they don't have speakers on them to make noise when they get lost. So this is using the Find My system that is very similar to AirTags. To make it so that you can kind of locate it in your couch if you have lost it. I'm surprised it took Apple this long to do it. The remote getting lost is something that they've been very well aware of in the 6 years that the Apple TV has had an easy to lose remote. But I'm glad it's here.
Well, and are they going to work on making the Apple TV remote easier to use for my father? Because he just cannot stand it.
Nope, they are obsessed with that design and are just trudging forward with it.
All right, so everyone has to get used to the Apple remote, but at least if you lose it, you'll now be able to find it again.
Unless it was lost on purpose.
Ah, I see. All right, well, this has been Tech Tuesday, and I want to say thank you to Russell Hawley, Managing Editor for Commerce at CNET. Thanks for being here, Russell.
Thanks for having me.
All right. And this is Tech Tuesday. This is All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. Thanks for joining us. And this is 89.7 NPR News.